buried 12 years. During the war. He was perfectly serious. Doesn't like it here, and he's making us sick. When we find him, we'll be on our way. I was too tired and felt myself beginning to laugh. I was trying to be funny when I said, "Have you checked the bridge foundations?" Duray looked at me for a moment, serious and unblinking. "Sure. It's the first place we looked."
Paddy Morahan and David Horovitch were reading The Tiger's Wife by Thea Obrecht. The abridger was Sally Marmion and the producer, Elizabeth Allard. Now here's Justin Edwards, and he seems to be doing up the house.
Prime the main stories of the week. Insert a load of sketches written by you. Cut some celebrities' egos down to size. Then file away any unwanted material before showing it off for all to see.
Newsjack, made for 4 Extra. Thursday evening at 10:30 and again on Sunday evening at 11.
And there you have it, a beautifully crafted topical comedy show. Which is a shame, really. I was hoping for a coffee table.
The digital station on radio, TV and online. BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Why has Leonardo da Vinci's Mona Lisa beguiled people through the ages? Who was this lady and what was her story? We continue The Lost Mona Lisa by R.A. Scotti.
Wrapped in the mystery of her disappearance was the enigma of Mona Lisa herself. We know from his pupil and secretary that Leonardo never threw away a drawing or a page of writing, and he filled thousands of pages with sketches and notes. Yet there is no trace of Mona Lisa, no preliminary studies of her, not a jotting. He left no clue to her identity except her smile. In 1550, the Florentine artist and author Giorgio Vasari christened the painting Mona Lisa. He identified the sitter as Lisa del Giocondo, the wife of a wealthy silk merchant. According to Vasari, Mona Lisa's story began in the wine country of Tuscany, where, in a picturesque farmhouse, a daughter was born to Anton Maria di Noldo Gherardini and his third wife. Anton Maria named the baby Lisa. 27 years earlier, near the village of Vinci, Leonardo was the product of a romp in the hay between Piero da Vinci and a peasant girl on his father's estate. His father would settle down in Florence and become a prominent notary, roughly equivalent to a lawyer today. Raised in his father's house, Leonardo grew up to be a Renaissance Adonis. Tall, broad-shouldered, and, according to a contemporary biographer, he had a beautiful head of hair, curled and carefully combed in golden ringlets that fell to the middle of his chest. He dressed in knee-length rose-coloured velvet tunics that showed off his legs. Gifted in every art and possessed of an endlessly curious mind, Leonardo did not blend into the landscape. Renaissance artists were travelling salesmen, brushes and chisels for hire, travelling from city-state to city-state, competing for commissions. After apprenticing in the workshop of a sculptor and painter, Leonardo left the humanist cradle of Florence for the sinister court of Ludovico Sforza, the Prince of Milan. He thrived at the Sforza court. Leonardo analysed how things worked. Then he used that knowledge to create visual fictions. "Painting is poetry that is seen," Leonardo said. And, like the poet, the painter must compose fictions that express great things. His studies of the muscles that move to form a smile, the dilation of the pupils in response to light, and the flow of water are evidenced in Mona Lisa. While Leonardo ventured off to Milan, Lisa stayed close to home. She must have been pretty and precocious, because just before her 16th birthday, she vaulted up the social ladder, marrying citizen and merchant Francesco del Giocondo. By 1503, when Lisa probably met Leonardo for the first time, the Giocondos were living in a fashionable new house in Florence with their growing family. Leonardo's circumstances were not as easy. In 1499, the French had wrested Milan from the Sforzas. Leonardo remained to complete his fresco of the Last Supper. Then he returned to Florence. He had left the city as a young man in the glory days of Lorenzo the Magnificent. Now he was almost 50, Lorenzo was dead, and the Renaissance was migrating south to Rome. No longer the unchallenged master, his finances strained, Leonardo da Vinci was looking for work. His father, the notary, probably wrangled a commission for his cash-poor son. He had recently settled a financial dispute for a wealthy silk merchant. And sometime during that unsettled decade, Leonardo began a portrait of the merchant's wife, Lisa. From the first glimpse on Leonardo's easel, Mona Lisa caused a stir. Few portraits went beyond a physical likeness. Most seemed static and impassive, just the head and shoulders. Mona Lisa is painted at eye level and almost life-size. Many artists made detailed studies and drew the outline of their paintings on the canvas or panel before they began to paint. X-rays reveal no underlying drawing and few pentimenti, false starts or adjustments. Leonardo painted Mona Lisa directly, changing only the placement of the hands and fingers. She sits on a loggia or balcony, her body angled and her face turned out, creating the impression that she is looking directly at the viewer. And if we try to look away, she follows us and will not let go. In the early 1500s, oil painting was a new medium and it involved considerable trial and error. To paint Mona Lisa, Leonardo took a delicate technique often used in watercolours called sfumato, a vanishing into smoke, and applied it to oils, using fine silk brushes to eliminate any trace of individual strokes. He applied very thin successive layers of paint and glazes so fine as to be almost evanescent. Mona Lisa's image is soft and blurred round the edges, like a photograph slightly out of focus. Mona Lisa was a departure for Leonardo. In his other portraits of privileged women, the subjects are dressed for posterity. Curled hair, laced bodices, ermine and jewels. Mona Lisa wears no hint of rank, and her dress is nondescript. Would a pretty young woman with a wealthy husband and an armoire full of the finest silks being painted for the first time by a celebrated artist choose a drab, brownish dress to wear and no jewellery? Her portrait would hang on the wall of her new house for all to admire. She would want to look her most beautiful. Perhaps Lisa's original choice was fuchsia silk, and the painter insisted she change into her plainest dress. Not wanting to offend him, she would have acquiesced. She was only in her 20s, a young mother, new to the more aristocratic society of the city, lately moved to a fancy house, and perhaps unsure of herself. But her disappointment must have been transparent, because Leonardo went to great lengths to dispel her gloom. He brought in an orchestra of musicians to cheer her, Vasari says, yet the most Mona Lisa could muster was the trace of a smile. It must have been a galling time for Leonardo. Donato Bramante, his old friend and collaborator from the Milan days, was in Rome building the monumental Basilica of St. Peter, and his young challengers were also being called to the Vatican. Michelangelo to sculpt a massive tomb for Pope Julius and later to paint the Sistine ceiling, Raphael to fresco the rooms of the Papal Palace. While they were in Rome becoming immortal, Leonardo was painting the young Signora del Giocondo. He would not make it a simple portrait. For each square yard Michelangelo covered of the Sistine ceiling, Leonardo painted about an inch. He carried her with him until the end of his life. She must have been with him in 1515, when he returned to Milan and met François I. Whether it was love at first sight or a gradual seduction, the young French king became infatuated with her. Like his English contemporary and friend, Henry VIII, François was a true gallant. He lusted for beauty in its manifold forms, art, architecture, lovers, wives, and he loved and admired all things Italian. He brought Italian artists to France, turned the Louvre fortress into a palace, and began to collect the art that would become the nucleus of its collection. He was so affected by the Last Supper that he wanted to move the entire wall to France. When that proved impractical, he offered to import its creator instead. His most celebrated coup was persuading Leonardo to emigrate. But why did Leonardo, standing in front of a painting, presumably Mona Lisa, in France in 1517, describe it as a portrait of a certain Florentine lady done from life at the instigation of the late Magnifico Giuliano de' Medici? Why would Giuliano de' Medici commission a portrait of a silk merchant's wife? There was no question of an affair between them. Did Leonardo paint two Mona Lisas? One for Giuliano de' Medici, never finished, because he died in 1516, and one for Francesco del Giocondo, never delivered? Or was he describing a different painting entirely? And if Mona Lisa is not Lisa del Giocondo, the silk merchant's wife, who is she? At some point after Leonardo's death, Mona Lisa began her new life in Fontainebleau, in the Appartement des Bains, the luxurious bathroom of François I. Since painters were often on hand to immortalize royal favorites in the bath, Mona Lisa was probably copied a number of times. In the ensuing decades, perhaps in a misguided effort to repair the effects of her bathroom days, Mona Lisa received a thick coat of lacquer. The clumsy conservation first dulled, then destroyed Leonardo's colors. Over time, the varnish cracked, producing a surface web of fine fissures called craquelures. Another young king, Louis XIV, came courting and swept her away to the royal bedroom in the new palace in Versailles. After his death, she was moved to a darkened hideaway where she waited out the madness of the French Revolution. With few exceptions, scant notice was taken of her until Napoleon arrived on the scene. By then, the Louvre was in its third incarnation. The fortress-turned-royal palace had been reconfigured as a museum during the Revolution, giving the king's collection to the people. Mona Lisa was one of the last works to move from Versailles to the Louvre, and she did not remain there long. Napoleon Bonaparte, the first emperor of the French, fell captive to her smile and transported her to his bedroom in the Tuileries Palace. He maintained her there until his defeat at Waterloo in 1815. Napoleon Bonaparte was the most notorious art thief in history. Such latter-day looters as Lord Elgin and Hermann Göring pale beside the Corsican plunderer as he charged across the continent. The Louvre, now named Musée Napoléon, soon filled with the emperor's plunder. Leonardo's work, after his death, had been neglected for years. In one of history's choice ironies, it was Napoleon's ravishment of the art of Italy that led to the rediscovery of the Renaissance wonder. In 1815, with Napoleon in exile, Mona Lisa returned to the Louvre. Now on public view, no longer enjoyed by kings and emperors alone, she began attracting the extravagant praise of connoisseurs. Hundreds, if not thousands, of books, articles and academic careers were built on the twin puzzles of Mona Lisa's identity and her meaning, until, in 1911, A third all-consuming mystery made the old questions irrelevant. Was Mona Lisa lost forever? By the end of 1911, her trail was as cold as the North Sea. The world intruded, dramatic new headlines pushing the caper off the front pages. The unsinkable Titanic lost on her maiden voyage. Scott loses race to pole and dies in the attempt. The Mona Lisa heist seemed to have been the perfect crime. Until, in 1913, a letter was sent from Leonardo.
Nicholas Grace was reading from The Lost Mona Lisa by R.E. Scotti, which was produced by Duncan Mitchell. Tomorrow, the trail takes us to Florence at the same time, 2:45.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 3 o'clock. Hello, this is Luke Tuddenham. I can offer you pignapping, private detection, impostering, fisticuffs and broken engagements this hour as Matt Lucas and Charles Dance star in Summer Lightning by P.G. Wodehouse. Later, we've a tale penned by the crime writer extraordinaire Ruth Rendell, 30 years on from the day he left his grandmother in her cold stone mansion, a middle-aged man returns to claim his inheritance in paperwork at 8:30. Now the first of a two-part drama. In 1929, P.G. Wodehouse published the second in a series of much-loved novels that was to become known as the Blanding Saga.
Summer Lightning by P.G. Wodehouse, starring Patricia Hodge, Charles Dance, Tim Pigott-Smith, Samuel West, Rachel Sterling, Jared Harris, Martin Jarvis and Matt Lucas, with Matthew Wolfe as Ronnie Fish and Lisa Dillon as Sue Brown. Ian Ogilvy is the voice of P.G. Wodehouse.
Blanding's castle slept in the sunshine. Ripples of heat mist played across its smooth lawns. The air was full of the lulling drone of insects. It was that gracious hour of a summer afternoon, midway between luncheon and tea, when nature seems to unbutton its waistcoat and put its feet up. In the shade of a laurel bush outside the back of this stately home of England, Beach, butler to Clarence, 9th Earl of Emsworth, its proprietor, sat reading a weekly paper devoted to the doings of society and the stage. The laurel bush, which had hitherto not spoken, said,
"Psst! I say Beach!
Psst!
I?
Psst!
Oh, Mr. Carmody, sir.
Did I startle you, Beach?
Extremely, sir.
I'm sorry. Beach, do you want to earn a quid?
Yes, sir.
Can you get hold of Miss Millicent? Alone?
Certainly, sir.
Then give her this note and don't let anyone see you do it, especially Lady Constance.
I will attend to the matter immediately, sir. Perhaps you are not aware, sir, that her ladyship went up to London on the 3:30 train.
You mean all this creeping from bush to bush has been a waste of time? Well, I'll come out of it, then.
I wish I'd known that before. I've severely injured a good suit.
No, well, allow me, sir.
Thanks. You know, Beach, life's rummy. Here I am at Blanding's Castle, loving it. And yet when the project of my coming here as Lord Emsworth's private secretary was first mooted, I don't mind telling you that the heart was rather bowed down with woe.
No doubt you were reluctant to leave London, sir.
Exactly. But now that old Ronnie's coming down here, joy, as you might say, will be unconfined.
Is Mr. Ronald expected, sir?
Tomorrow or the day after. I say, what was that thing I saw you cutting out of the paper just now?
Oh, a photograph of Mr. Galahad, sir. Would you care to see the clipping? There is a reference to Mr. Galahad's literary work.
Oh, let's see. A pretty perky snap of old Galley. The Hon. Galahad Threepwood, brother of the Earl of Emsworth. A little bird tells us that Galley is at Blanding's Castle, Shropshire, the ancestral seat of the family, busily engaged in writing his reminiscences. They ought to be as warm as the weather, if not warmer. Thanks. Has it ever occurred to you, Beach, that this book of his is going to make no small stir when it comes out?
Frequently, sir. Mr. Galahad was somewhat wild as a young man.
Well, I'm saving up for my copy. Thank you, Beach. I must be getting about my duties. You won't forget that note, will you?
Vinci! Quite, capital.
Hello!
Tea, Millicent?
Hello, Uncle Clarence. Yes, please. You've been down seeing the Empress.
Eh? Oh, yeah. sit down, my dear. You, Paul. I've been with her all the afternoon.
What do you do to her? Read her bedtime stories?
I do. She's in wonderful shape. I've every hope she'll win the silver medal in the fat pigs class at the Shropshire Agricultural Show. Second year in succession.
I'm so glad. Mr. Carmody told me he had never seen a finer animal in his life.
Carmody? I like that young man. He's sound on pigs.
He's an improvement on Rupert Baxter, isn't he?
Baxter. Dreadful fellow.